You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
I'm Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday.
And I'm Kristen Meinzer, co-author of How to Be Fine.
Together, we host Movie Therapy with Rafer and Kristen.
In each episode, we read letters from real people in real quandaries.
Then we dispense a bit of questionable advice.
And finally, we prescribe movies and TV shows to help our listeners through whatever ails them.
It's part advice show, part watch list, and lots of laughs.
Listen to Movie Therapy with Rafer and Kristen wherever you get your favorite shows.
That's Movie Therapy with Rafer and Kristen.
No matter how good we are at what we do, no matter how normal the day begins, things just go wrong. Sometimes we see it coming, but most times we simply don't. I'm Frank Sapovitz, the host of When Things Go Wrong. You'll meet fascinating people who had to manage difficult problems, often under tremendous pressure. From business leaders, law enforcement pros, athletes, actors, and more, you'll hear stories of tragedy and triumph and learn how they met crisis head on. Find When Things Go Wrong on your favorite podcast app.
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. HBO's two-part documentary, The Crime of the Century, is a searing indictment of Big Pharma and the political operatives and government regulations that enabled overproduction, reckless distribution, and abuse of synthetic opiates. Exploring the origins, extent, and fallout of one of the most devastating public health tragedies of our time, with 500,000 deaths from overdoses this century alone, the film reveals that America's opioid epidemic is not a public health crisis that came out of nowhere. And today, I welcome the acclaimed Emmy and Oscar-winning director of The Crime of the Century, Alex Gibney, back to the podcast to discuss how he says pharmaceutical companies deliberately got America hooked on opioids. We talk about the questionable tactics employed by sales teams to convince doctors to overprescribe drugs like OxyContin, the name-brand pharmacies that have helped put drugs on the street, and the politicians and government regulators who turned a blind eye all along. Plus, how the pandemic has made America's opioid addiction much, much worse. Coming up with Alex Gibney in just a moment. HBO's The Crime of the Century is a two-part documentary directed by Emmy and Academy Award winner Alex Gibney. It's a searing indictment of Big Pharma and the political operatives and government regulations that enable overproduction, reckless distribution, and abuse of synthetic opiates. It's now available on HBO Max, and today Alex joins me on the podcast to talk about it. Alex, welcome back.
Thanks, Ben.
I have to say, this film was a huge eye-opener for me, and I'm sure many people, because I think for many Americans, it almost seems like the opioid epidemic just came out of nowhere, almost as if it was an accident or some kind of unintended consequence gone amok. You assert in this film that that is not the case at all. How deliberate was this epidemic?
I mean, I think it was manufactured. And when I say that, I don't mean that companies went out and tried to create overdoses. But I think that a number of companies, government officials, doctors, pharmacies, all conspired in what, to my mind, is a crime because they put profits over people. They were more interested in making money off of a drug and falsely proclaiming both its benefits and its lack of dangers in a way that hoodwinked a lot of people, got them addicted to drugs, and then led to very, very, very serious and sometimes fatal unintended consequences.
And you did title this documentary The Crime of the Century. That's a pretty bold proclamation. Could you think of anything over the past 20 years that comes close to this?
Not really. I mean, I suppose you could say COVID, but COVID, you know, however, and I made a film about the failure of the federal response to COVID. That said, you can properly say that COVID was a pandemic. In the case of the opioid crisis, you know, this didn't have to have happened. And that's why, with the body count being as high as it is, 500,000 dead from opioid overdoses, that I have to think of it as the kind of the crime of the century. And honestly, it goes beyond the overdoses. It goes to the number of people addicted. It goes to the enormous cost of trillions of dollars, literally, of law enforcement, healthcare, emergency care, addiction treatment, so forth and so on. Terrible, terrible cost.
And since you mentioned your other film, Totally Under Control, which was about the COVID-19 epidemic, I'm curious, do you see any similarities between how America handled both of these crises, the opioid crisis and the pandemic?
Yes. In both cases, we put notions of supply and demand, profit share, profit, ahead of the essential elements of the Hippocratic Oath. Instead of focusing on what's best for the patient, we thought that if we just think about what's best for the profit of big corporations, everything will work out fine. Well, it turns out it doesn't work out fine. It works out sometimes just the opposite. It's this unholy alliance of healthcare and 21st century turbocharged capitalism that I think is so dangerous.
Mm-hmm. And to get to the origin story of this opioid epidemic, it really begins with the Sackler family and this company that they founded, Purdue Pharmaceuticals. Tell us a little bit about the Sacklers and how they got into this business.
Well, they got into it originally, I suppose, through a gentleman named Arthur Sackler. Now, Arthur Sackler didn't have anything to do with OxyContin. But Arthur Sackler was a doctor who had been at Creedmoor Psychiatric Institute and had seen sort of the brutality of how mental illness was sometimes treated with things like lobotomies and electroshock therapy, and became determined to seek out ways in which chemicals or pharmaceuticals could be used to treat the same ailments. Along the way, he became quite a potent figure in a pharmaceutical advertising firm called McAdams, and ended up being the key guy to promote two drugs that became very famous. One was Librium and one was Valium, sort of mood-altering drugs. And he did this by expanding the notion of the market, that instead of focusing on a very narrow market for which these drugs were originally intended, he sought to market them to the widest possible audience, which is, of course, just what happened later with OxyContin. The same thing he did was he developed a marketing and sales strategy that would focus on doctors, both to give them the hard sell and the soft sell, and sometimes to falsely proclaim attributes to drugs in ways that would get them prescribed by doctors. Now, Arthur Sackler's nephew, Richard Sackler, becomes the person who is really the driving force behind OxyContin. Purdue Pharma in the 90s had a drug called MS-Contin, which is a morphine-based time-release drug. And it was effective for end-of-life cancer pain, principally, because that's a time in one's life in which you don't really have to worry about addiction, sadly. As the patent for MS-Contin was running out, they devised a new drug called OxyContin, which is oxycodone, another opioid, twice as powerful as morphine, but also with this Contin system, this time-release system. So the idea is you take it, and then over the course of 12 hours, it slowly releases so you don't get those highs and lows that would be so difficult for, you know, somebody who's abusing drugs like opioids. But they made a number of claims about OxyContin that just were false. One was that it couldn't be abused. And frankly, it was very easy to abuse it, as they themselves proved. They had done their own studies that showed if you crush it and then either snort it or mix it with water and extract the contents with a hypodermic needle and then inject the same into your body, you can get very high, very fast, very quickly, in ways that sometimes can be very dangerous.
Now, this may be a dumb question, Alex, but what is the difference between opioids and heroin? Is there one?
No, heroin is an opioid. So oxycodone, morphine, heroin, they all come from the opium poppy. They're just different mixtures.
Interesting. When you look at these big pharma companies, is there much difference between a Mexican drug cartel and these big corporate opioid pushers?
Well, there's one big difference. One operates in a legal context and one operates in an illegal context. That said, one of the things we discovered, and it was also discovered by Patrick Keefe, who's just written this wonderful book about the sack that's called Empire of Pain, was that in many cases, they have the same kind of business model. The idea is really to promote the drug to people so that they will use it and then slowly titrate up to keep increasing the doses so the drug dealers will sell more and more. Very often, they both hand out free samples in order to get people hooked. And their mechanisms of supply and demand are also very similar. So when you look at the business model of the cartels without examining, you know, the fact that they're illegal and they often kill people, but just the business model, the economic model of what they're doing, it's not very dissimilar from what Purdue Pharma or some of these other pharmaceutical firms would do.
And in the documentary, you say that Purdue pushed doctors to expand the definition of pain. I'm curious, how did they do that?
Well, remember that OxyContin was originally recommended for so-called breakthrough pain, that is to say, really excruciating pain, particularly at the end of life for cancer patients, right? So when you expand the definition of pain, the whole idea is to say, well, pain is pain. Let's not distinguish between them. And let's run a scale. And maybe these drugs could be very useful. They don't have to be for breakthrough pain. How about chronic pain? Let's say you have a knee injury. You're 18 years old. You have a sports injury. And it's painful. And it's likely to be painful over a couple of weeks. How about some OxyContin? So the idea is to expand the notion of pain beyond what the drug was intended for, which, you know, in its limited use was a good drug. The other thing was this all happens at a time when there is a way of thought that has emerged, which was that we've been under-treating pain, that pain itself is a kind of fifth vital sign, that we have to be very attentive to it. And so into that kind of notion comes a robust sales plan, you know, orchestrated by Purdue Pharma related to OxyContin. It's like, we're under treating pain. We've got just the pill for you, the one to start with and the one to stay with.
And it's funny because, you know, pain is not necessarily a bad thing. You know, it's your body's natural way of telling you when something's wrong. We sort of ignore those signals at our peril, don't we?
Right. Sometimes, I mean, in the past, there was a period of time when actually doctors thought pain was a good thing in the sense that it showed that the body was attuned to invasiveness, as you say, and also that it would result in healing mechanisms. But then there was a change of thinking in that.
Yeah. And I want to ask you about one of the doctors who very aggressively tried to expand that definition of pain and a patient who actually died as a result of that. I'm, of course, talking about Carol Bosley and her doctor, Lynn Webster. Can you tell that story?
Sure. So Lynn Webster was very much one of those people who was preaching the gospel of pain management, which is to say, we're under-treating pain, and people have sometimes excruciating pain, which is so bad that it can actually lead them to suicide. And unless we figure out a way to treat that pain and treat that pain over the long term, you know, we're making a terrible, terrible, terrible mistake. Lynn Webster, you know, directly or indirectly, also was on the receiving end of a lot of speaking payments by some of these big pharmaceutical companies who were very much pushing this idea. So you can kind of get this sense of how financial incentives, either consciously or unconsciously, began to intrude into a sort of pure doctor-patient relationship. Now, Lynn Webster had a clinic in Salt Lake City called the Life Tree Clinic, which was a pain clinic. And people would go there if they had what they perceived to be chronic pain. And one of his patients was a woman named Carol Bosley. Her husband, Carol, had had a terrible car accident and was in a lot of pain. She went to Lynn Webster's Life Tree Pain Clinic and was given some pretty potent opioids by Dr. Webster, as well as some other medicines, which in combination were dangerous. And her husband was very concerned because he felt she was taking so many opioids that she was in a haze all the time and couldn't even remember the fact that she'd already taken them. And so she would take more, that the doctor had radically overprescribed pain medications. Went to see the doctor, who's not, Dr. Webster wasn't particularly attentive, but finally her husband took Carol to somebody else who got her off opioids, put her on another kind of pain management system, mostly revolving around Tylenol. And she seemed to be doing much, much better. And then Dr. Webster reached out to her. She came in and, against the advice of her husband and her family, began to take opioids again. And not long after that, she overdosed.
Now, some of the most damning evidence in this documentary is actually a 120-page Justice Department memo about Purdue Pharma. What, for you, were the most shocking revelations in that memo?
There were two. One is the terribly unethical relationship between a medical examiner at the FDA and Purdue Pharma. In fact, this person who worked at the FDA, a medical officer named Curtis Wright, actually sat down for 3 days with representatives of Purdue Pharma to work out the wording of the review of Purdue's own application. So Purdue is effectively writing the review of its own application to the FDA, thanks to this FDA official. Now, one of the things that comes of that is that in the package insert, the literature that accompanies the drug, two claims were made that were not credible at all. One was that because of the time release mechanism, this drug wasn't subject to abuse, which it was, and Purdue knew very well that it was. And number two, that you could take, you know, up to 60 milligrams of OxyContin over a long period of time and then stop like that, and there wouldn't be any ill effects. Back to Curtis Wright, it's interesting to note that having given Purdue permission to include this information in its package insert, which was a hugely valuable marketing tool in terms of going out to doctors, a year and a month or so after he left the FDA, he's hired by, guess who? Purdue Pharma, for a compensation close to $400,000 a year, which back in the day, in the late 90s, was quite a tidy sum of money. It's still quite a tidy sum of money.
And yet, no one, as far as the Purdue Pharma executives, have ever been charged with any kind of a crime. Why not?
It's not to say they haven't been charged. What happened was there was a federal investigation into fraud charges. In other words, a number of U.S. attorneys from Western Virginia who were concerned about the scarily rising rates of opioid overdoses began to investigate Purdue Pharma to see if Purdue was falsely marketing its drug, proclaiming its safety and efficacy in ways that were unreasonable. And so they started an investigation which lasted for 2 or 3 years and produced a 120-page prosecution memo, which was a recommendation to prosecute key Purdue executives and indeed to prosecute them for felonies, which if convicted, would have sent them to prison for a long period of time. This goes up to the top levels of the Department of Justice. All along the way, the career prosecutors are saying, this is such a powerful and potent piece of evidence, we really must go to trial on this. But at the very tippy top of the justice, not at the level of the Attorney General, but just below, a decision is made, and nobody will take responsibility for that decision even today and look very hard to try to ascertain, is one of two people. In any event, they make a decision to cut a deal with Purdue, and they allow the Purdue executives to plead guilty to a misdemeanor, which means they don't do a day in prison. They charge Purdue as an abstract entity with a felony, and then they assess a $600 million fine. But the most important thing about that is not only do no executives go to jail to send a powerful message, but in addition, all of the most potent evidence relating to Purdue's alleged crimes are now buried. That was part of the deal. So the public at large doesn't see these pernicious sales practices that Purdue is engaging in, which are causing people to become wildly addicted to OxyContin and also resulting in widespread abuse.
And one of these people who got off was actually the chairman and CEO, Richard Sackler. But you actually uncovered a video from a deposition with him. How would you describe him in that video? Does he seem remorseful?
I would say he's the opposite of remorseful and shows no regrets whatsoever. He exhibits a personality that looks to be very much on the spectrum, not somebody who seems particularly empathetic, shall we say, toward the victims of opioid abuse. And indeed, the corporate strategy, very much engineered by Richard Sackler, is not to take any responsibility for opioid abuse, but to blame the addict, to essentially say there are two kinds of people, good people and drug addicts. And drug addicts are going to abuse drugs no matter what. So it's not our fault. We, Purdue Pharma, made a perfectly good drug. It's not our problem that people are abusing it. But the fact is, you know, Purdue back in the 90s did their own study called the Spoon and Shoot study. And what they did was they thought, well, we've got this time release mechanism that's supposed to keep it from being abused, this drug. But what if you just crush the drug and snorted it? Or what if you crushed it and then mixed it with water and put it in a hypodermic needle and injected it? What would happen then? Well, what they discovered was, you know, because it was oxycodone, a very potent narcotic, and because it was now undiluted or now could be, you know, ingested directly, was hugely potent and powerful, and became, and this was a phrase that was used inside the Purdue company by a number of people we talked to, became something known as hillbilly heroin to the people at Purdue. They knew very well that they had an abuse problem with this drug on their hands, but they purposely didn't do anything about it. And when it was brought to their attention, they claimed it was the first time they had ever heard about the potential for abuse.
So if Purdue and Oxy are sort of the original sins of the opioid epidemic, things really get infinitely worse with the drugs that followed. How did we go from bad to worse?
Well, in part, the answer to that is an economic answer. Purdue wanted to increase its supply of drugs so it could make more money. To increase the supply, you need to create a demand. And that's the expansion of pain, right? So now you have this greater demand for OxyContin by doctors who are convinced that we're undertreating pain. And along the way, individuals are starting to get addicted to OxyContin. Sometimes they also abuse OxyContin. In both cases, the addiction leads to an economic problem. Perhaps I can't afford it anymore. Perhaps my doctor won't prescribe ever growing doses. So in that case, what do? Well, many people turn to heroin because it was cheaper. And when heroin proved too expensive, they turned to fentanyl. And fentanyl is a synthetic opioid, which is 50 times more potent than heroin and can be extremely dangerous if you don't properly dose it. It can lead to very rapid overdoses. DEA people we talked to said that they would often come across DOAs where people would still have the fentanyl pipe in their hands because it killed them so quickly. That's the problem. It's a problem of supply and demand where the pharmaceutical companies were very good at getting people on drugs, but not so very good at getting them off drugs.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more when we return in just a minute.
Hey, this is Mark Bittman. You might know me from How to Cook Everything, or The New York Times, or The Bittman Project. I cover all things food, from cooking to gardening to fabulous ingredients to junk food, health, sustainability, even policy. You might say I'm obsessed with everything about food, and that's why I've started a podcast called, appropriately enough, Food. Each week on Food, I'll sit down with a different guest, ranging from Samantha Irby to Tom Colicchio to Ted Danson, and to important people in the food world you may not yet know about. We'll talk about cooking, eating, and how food affects us all, our lives, our health, our planet. We'll talk recipes, ingredients, how to shop, what to cook tonight, and what you can do to help build a better food system. We'll even take your questions and give advice. cooking, and otherwise. Whatever you want will be fair game. From how to boil an egg, to how to feed your picky toddler, to how to increase people's control over the role food plays in our lives. Food is the one substance that connects everything to everything else, and it connects us all. Not only can we not live without it, not only does it determine much of what goes on in the world, but we love it. So subscribe now to Food with Mark Bittman on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't miss my first episode, May 24th, with my special guest, the fabulous Nigella Lawson.
And one of the most colorful people that you spoke with in sort of the post-Purdue era here was Alec Berkoloff.
Alec Berkoloff.
And he's sort of this fast-talking former VP of sales at a company called Insys Therapeutics. He's the very definition of a slick salesman. He's like something out of a David Mamet play. How did you get him to talk?
Alec Berkoloff, we were able to get him to talk because he had pled guilty to a felony. There was an investigation into Insys, the company he worked for many of these things that Purdue did. In fact, Insys was very much following the Purdue playbook, but on steroids. They were essentially bribing doctors to prescribe the drug with speaker fees, and they were also gaming the insurance system by falsely making claims about, you know, the patient's condition to insurance companies so that they could get those prescriptions paid for. So it was a huge conspiracy. To Alec Berkoloff, he was a vice president of sales for Insys, and he pled guilty as part of this investigation, and we reached out to him and he agreed to talk. And one of the great things about Alec was he was very candid about the way he used to sell the drug, and he could embody that salesperson and that perspective and the enthusiasm with which he went about his work, even though it was terribly dangerous and probably caused a lot of people their lives. You know, he used to identify, he had a color coding system for doctors, reds, blues, greens, and yellows. The reds were the businessmen. The other ones he didn't want to deal with because it would be too difficult to sell them. But the businessmen had what Alec called a slogan called "Whiff 'em, what's in it for me?" And it was basically like, okay, sure, I might consider prescribing your drug. How much are you going to pay me in speaker fees? And they might give him $10,000 in speaking fees. But here was the rub. Insys was so profit-oriented that they actually demanded a 2-to-1 return on investment. So if you got $10,000 of speaker fees, you had to write $20,000 of subsist prescriptions or they were going to knock you off their program. So that's the very definition of a bribe. They were bribing doctors to prescribe massive amounts of synthetic opioids to people who didn't necessarily need them. It was terrifying. But Alec Berkoloff was the face of that. And the other face of it was a video that Insys had produced as part of their titration campaign, where you have this rap, you know, kind of set to an ASAP Rocky song, which basically with these two guys outlining the criminal scheme that they were engaged in.
Yeah, complete with a dancing inhaler.
A dancing substance inhaler. And Alec Berkoloff, in order, you know, to play things up at the big sales conference, agreed to don the inhaler costume at the very end and pretend to be the guy in the bottle.
Yeah, the way he describes what he did, it's as if it was the greatest time in his life, even today. And these sales reps, I mean, they're a wild bunch. Some of these sales conferences were just nuts. I mean, it's pretty obscene.
Through some of our digging, we found never before seen videotapes of Purdue sales conferences in which everyone's dancing to a rock and roll band talking about how much we're going to sell OxyContin, sell MS-Contin. There's not a lot of lyrics related to the benefit for the patient. It all has to do with bonuses and profit margins and sales figures. And indeed, I believe a year after that sales conference video, they topped Viagra as the top-selling drug.
Wow. But the problem is not just the drug companies and the doctors. Pharmacies play a role as well. In fact, you exposed several pharmacies in Florida, including some name brands like CVS, whose opioid sales just suddenly exploded from one year to the next, unexplainably. How did that not raise any red flags?
Well, it didn't raise any red flags because nobody wanted the red flags to be raised. Because if you raise the red flags, then you're cutting back on your profits. I mean, there was, as part of a DEA investigation, they went to one CVS pharmacy where patients would line up around the block starting around 4 or 5 in the morning for their prescriptions of OxyContin. And an undercover agent spoke to one of the reps at the pharmacy who said, "Oh, don't worry, you know, we cut off sales to all those people around 2 or 3 o'clock. And they said, "Why do you do that?" And he said, "Well, we have to save some of the drug for our real pain patients." I.e., they knew very well that they were selling to people who were abusing the drug, not people who really needed it for medical care. Now, and this is true in spades for the largest pharmaceutical distributors. There's three globe-girdling companies, Cardinal Health, AmerisourceBergen, and, oh gosh, I can't even remember the third company right now. And these companies, we learned through the investigative team at the Washington Post, with whom we worked very closely on this film, they obtained access to a so-called Arcos database, which showed that these pharmaceutical distributors knew where every pill was going, down to every pharmacy and every small town in America. So if you have a town of 2,000 people and they're getting 1 million pills, you probably have a pretty good idea that those pills aren't there for back pain. They're being diverted. They're being diverted for, let's say, a non-medicinal use.
And I want to talk a little about this supply chain, because all of this has led to an explosion of opioids on the streets. How do prescription pharmaceuticals find their way onto the black market and in such massive quantities?
It's a number of ways. I mean, sometimes it's through pill mills, and a pill mill might be a place where you go and for cash, a doctor will write you a prescription for, say, OxyContin, and then, you know, you can go just down the hall and you can get that prescription filled, because what they're doing is just, you know, filling a demand without any real reckoning with a medical need. And people would travel the Oxy Highway from Western Virginia or Virginia down to Florida, where these practices tend to be rampant. And they would load up on OxyContin and they would come back and they would sell it on the black market. This is called diversion at the DEA. That is to say, diverting a drug from a regulated medical use to an illicit use. And this was happening a lot. And in order for it to happen, it takes a number of bad actors working in concert.
Yeah, I have to ask, are the drug companies knowingly allowing or facilitating prescription pharmaceuticals onto the illegal market? You know, if you're just looking at this from a dollars and cents perspective, I mean, they're still getting paid one way or another, regardless of the end user or how they buy this stuff.
I think you have to look at it as willful denial. In other words, I didn't find any evidence of a pill mill doctor going to Purdue or Cardinal Health and saying, "Hey, I'm running a pill mill and I'm getting a lot of drugs to drug addicts and I want you to give me a massive supply." It doesn't happen like that. So, you know, the distributor will say, "Well, look, we just got an order from the pharmacy. How are we supposed to know?" And the pharmacy says, "Well, we just got a prescription. How are we supposed to know?" And the fact is, there are checks and balances built into the system where you are supposed to know. If suddenly you have a level of prescriptions in a particular area go wildly up, well, that's a sign. And you're supposed to notify the DEA that there might be a problem, and the DEA investigates. But what would happen is pharmacies wouldn't notify the DEA, distributors wouldn't notify the DEA, manufacturers wouldn't notify the DEA. Why? Because if they did, sales might go down. And so you can pretend, you can just sit there and think, "Well, we don't want to interrupt the flow of opioids to valid pain patients, so let's just not say anything."
But what of the government's role in all this? I mean, Donald Trump, he made a big show of appointing his opioid czar, Chris Christie, and he was going to be the president who really tackled the crisis because these were his people. You know, these were populations mostly affected by opioids who were white, lower class, rural Americans, MAGA country. For all the bluster, did he do anything to curb this epidemic, and more specifically, anything to rein in the companies like Purdue and Insys?
I think when we're talking about government failure, and government failure here is massive, we spoke about the failure at the tippy top of the Justice Department to hold Purdue to account when they had an opportunity to do so. And I think, and you mentioned Donald Trump, it is true that Donald Trump appointed his drug czar, somebody who was responsible for undermining the DEA in terms of going after these places. But I think you'd also have to be honest and say the Obama administration also failed us as well. There was a bill in Congress that was sponsored by and very much promoted by the pharmaceutical industry, particularly the opioid manufacturers and distributors, that was meant to cripple the DEA's ability to use enforcement mechanisms to really crack down on diversion. That bill sailed through Congress and actually passed by unanimous consent. And it was likely written by the pharmaceutical industry. But it was presented in such a way by somebody who had been a former DEA official who now is part of the revolving doors working for Big Pharma, so that everybody lets it go. And they let it go because they don't think it's particularly important, and also because they're all getting massive contributions from the pharmaceutical companies themselves. So government fails us because they're not willing to hold to account pharmaceutical companies who just happen to be massively filling their campaign coffers. And they don't have time to read the bills properly because they're spending all their days raising money instead of doing what they should be doing, which is governing.
Yeah, absolutely. What we were just talking about, how disproportionately affects Trump voters, you know, for lack of a better word, rural white working class areas like West Virginia, Kentucky, Maine, they've been particularly hard hit by the opioid crisis. And I don't actually know why. Maybe you can help me with this. Can you explain why it's hit those places so hard? I mean, these drugs are not cheap as opposed to New York or LA.
It's a complicated answer. Some of it has to do with mechanisms inside certain states which make diversion and abuse a little bit more difficult. So states that are a little bit more highly regulated have complicated sets of restrictions that make diversion harder. So in states like West Virginia or Maine or West Virginia, you know, it's easier to divert. The other part of this is that, you know, sometimes states with extremely high rates of unemployment facing an uncertain future are more prone to abusing opioids than other places might be. But I'm not speaking to that. I'm suggesting that as something anecdotal that I suspect is happening rather than something for which I have hardcore evidence.
To wrap it up here, I just want to bring it to the present. Has the opioid addiction gotten worse during the pandemic? I would assume so.
Yes, it has. And fentanyl is particularly a problem. Now, pharmaceutical companies will say, you know, they'll say, well, what do we have to do with fentanyl? But this goes back to what I'm talking about, or what I was talking about earlier, which is these companies created a demand for opioids that now must be sated through the illicit trafficking of fentanyl.
Well, once again, it was very eye-opening, and I really encourage people to see this documentary. Once again, Alex Gibney's two-part documentary, The Crime of the Century, is now available on HBO Max. Alex, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks so much, Ben. Great pleasure.
Thanks again to Alex Gibney for coming on the show. His two-part documentary, The Crime of the Century, is now available on HBO Max. And you can follow Alex on Twitter at Alex Gibney Film. If you enjoyed today's episode, then subscribe and give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Detailed reviews are the best way for new listeners to discover the show. Follow us on Facebook at KickAssNewsPod and email me with your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. KickAss News is a part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com and check out some of our other shows like Food with Mark Bittman, Movie Therapy, Investing for Beginners, My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, and many others. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.
An Airwave Media Podcast.